capital, equity stakes, funding, IPO, private firms. If these terms seem like jigsaw puzzle pieces for you, don't worry. We at Broadcast Today will be solving the most anticipated and challenging puzzle of all time, venture capitalism in the product world. Thank you for listening to the broadcast. I'm Aishwarya, your host, and today with me, I have Vinod Kumar Shankar, Associate Vice President of KStart Capital, a unique seed program designed for the next generation Indian entrepreneurs. With 12 plus years of experience as an engineer and investor, Vinod is all set to simplify this whole VC concept for us. Thank you for joining me, Vinod. It's a pleasure to host you.
Hey, thanks, Aishwarya, for having me. I'm happy to join and help and, you know, demystify as much as possible for your audience about what is venture capital and what is funding and equity. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. So let's begin with the basics. Could you break down what venture capitalists do? What's the role like, and who or what do you deal with, and how do you fit this whole seed program in this product world?
There's two ways to deal with it, right? You know, I think how would it fit in the product world is a question which I keep thinking about. And let's break down venture capital first. You know, what typically I do over a period of time, or you know, what's the typical roles? The three things, you know, which I do. One, I think a lot of people, you, me, and everybody keeps wondering, or you know, that's where you know everybody sees. You know, there's a lot of action happening where you know we go meet startups. We see a lot of the founders. You know, we talk to founders. You know, that's what I call the first 30% or 1/3 of what a VC does. You know, which is much more visible, much more glamorous, or you know, looks like you know you're talking to a lot of people. That's the sourcing part, I would call. The second part, you know, once you source them, you evaluate them, you go through the grind of, you know, looking at competition, market size, all these factors, you know, of evaluation. And, you know, of, let's say, you know, of 100 companies that you source, you know, probably one or, you know, two kind of goes through and gets invested by a typical VC. That's kind of the potential possibility. That's the second phase, you know, where you evaluate. Once you evaluate and make the investment, the bigger part of the job, you know, is trying to help the founders manage the portfolio of companies and also having a healthy portfolio. In a way, you know, VCs have at least an advantage, I would say, you know, compared to the founders, that you have a portfolio where even if one or two bets go sore, they still have like the remaining company. Hopefully one of them emerges as winner. And the whole VC model, you know, as you know, a lot of people have spoken in the past about it, is driven by a kind of power law. You really need like one or two large wins out of 10 companies for you to really make all the money of the fund and return more than the fund. So that's why, you know, it's a portfolio bet, is less like de-risked compared to, you know, a founder who's taking a shot at, or a product owner who's taking a shot at, you know, one single product at a given point in time and putting all his time and resources. So that's the second piece of, you know, what we do. Portfolio management is what I would call it. The last piece, you know, is largely to do with exits, helping the companies raise money, using all the potential networks that you have, you know, doing exit management, you know, as much as you do portfolio management, helping company exit and creating exits, right, is also a large part of the task, you know, which is kind of not very visible to most people. Mm-hmm. So these exit management is critical as much as, you know, we do the first two pieces. So this is largely where I get and spend my time on sourcing, portfolio management and exit management across a period of time, you know, over a fund's life cycle, between 8 to 10 years.
Interesting. Actually, you know, as glamorous as this entire role of a VC is, I think you've done enough justice now to break down the whole process, starting with the sourcing, moving on to evaluating and finding the portfolio management, and the last part being the exit management. It's interesting to know that this whole process consists of, you know, step-by-step procedure to find the startups, to actually help them out with a incomplete portfolio, and also help them find the right capital when they're exiting.
Very familiar, but let's see how the whole portfolio thing works for typical VCs, right? Let's assume you invest in 10 companies equally at like maybe $1 million. You put in your first 10 million equally across, you know, 1 million each across 10 companies, then you realize, you know, oh, the four companies are doing, you know, good of the six. I'm just saying, you know, doing good, you know, in terms of your revenue metrics, in terms of, you know, gaining market share, in terms of the product and multiple other pieces, you know, they're all showing signs and indications and meeting their milestones. Then what VCs typically do is they develop on those four or five companies. They put, let's say, another couple of millions into these companies. Then of the four or five companies, then again, you know, you do a self-selection. This is completely a process, you know, which is driven by self-selection, I would say. You know, as the companies do well, you double up on them and you again double up, triple up on them. Eventually, you know, you would have put a good chunk, you know, maybe let's say 20% of your entire fund into one or two companies. And those companies are expected to be winners. And that one company alone may end up returning anywhere between, you know, 5x to 10x of the capital if it's really a large company. The 5 to 10x, you know, eventually would add up to like 3x of the fund. So when we say this power law venture returns model, right, really it plays out extremely in a non-linear way, right? You are expecting absolutely that you're going to have at least half of your, or let's say about 25% of your portfolio not to return the money, another 25-30% to just about return your money, and another 25 to just give you about, like, say 2 to 3x kind of a money. And that one last company, or like that 5% chance that you're going to get a really large winner, which is going to give you either sometimes as big as 50x, 30 to 50, those are the possibilities. So I think all of us consciously, every time we look at a company, when we evaluate a company, right, we are consciously thinking, is this the company that's going to give us that 40, 50x? Because every bet, whenever you're making that bet, right, is... are we looking at a company which can give us 30 to 40x? Obviously, you know, later we realize, you know, this may not do that. But every time we make an evaluation, we're looking for a company which is going to give us 30 to 50x kind of a number, at least.
Yeah, that makes sense right now. And the example that you stated to explain the whole concept also is very understandable. And I think the whole power law is sort of like a probability, or like a game that you keep evaluating at each stage, where you move on to have the set of startups, and then you, you know, you have a couple of them go away, and finally you find that right winner out of a game. Like,
yes, true.
So now we were talking about these companies and finding them out and seeing which, you know, startup could return the so much revenue for you. So in going by that lines, what are the top three things you look out for in such product teams or startups before you set out to invest? You know, some prefer like a proven revenue track record or like a winning idea of a founder. But that apart, what's your theory?
So actually, I think, you know, one thing I was thinking, you know, firstly, I think that, to, you know, different archetypes of founders, when we talk of product founders, and then there are sales-driven founders, and then there are technical founders. When we break it up, right, you know, sometimes you take a shot at, you know, different kind of founders. You know, there'll be multiple archetypes. And specifically, right, if you are looking for a product-driven founder, I mean, that's where I understand your question is. Great examples, right? You know, YC goes after technical founder. They look for, you know, somebody who can code or create. You know, that's where the thought process is, you know, or is it like not exactly the exact, really a product founder? And a sales driven founder is somebody who's able to tell a story, is able to sell himself, is able to recruit a founder, is able to recruit. And a product founder, in my mind, right, a product founder uses the product itself to make the sale or market itself at some level. That's how I kind of view it as. I mean, if you have another viewpoint, I'm happy to listen to that. But that's how I imagine, you know, a product founder is it looks like. Example, you know, when I think of product founders, I thought of, you know, Superhuman. This is a very clear, you know, case where the product itself is kind of driven the entire story. And I mean, and the founder's past, obviously, there is a track record also, especially in the Superhuman's case. But when we look for product founders, right, and if we realize, you know, this is somebody, he's a product founder, I think, you know, you look for, you know, how good is the product, you know, how, what's the ease of use, you know, can it drive itself, can it like sell by itself, you know, you don't need like a sales founder, or you don't need a large sales organization, you don't need a lot of marketing dollars to go ahead, right, because the product itself should drive the whole thing if it's driven by a product founder. That's my view on that. So if we look for characteristics for generally for typically what we look for, you know, quality of the founders, you know, what have they done in the past, And is this market, you know, that's visible right now, you know, what is the potential market size? And is there a quality of disruption in this? You know, is this like already there are like six guys who are doing this? Is this the seventh guy? Or is this something new? Is there is a sense of, you know, disruption possibility in this market? And are they thinking new? When we say disruption, it's not like we're like looking for something out of the world. Something as simple as, you know, can I do a fast browser? Can I do a fast email in case of a superhuman with a great interface, right? That's what you'd evaluate from a particular product founder. These are like largely the, you know, characteristics that, you know, we look for, you know, where the founders, what kind of market size, is there some disruption or something unique that's coming out, you know, from this thought process? And do we have unique insights, you know, which nobody has uncovered it yet in the market, and their understanding of the market and unique insights? I think these three, four characteristics is what we look for and then evaluate further to see, you know, where it leads to. And also an important question to always ask is, you know, is this a founder who will do this particular product? Does it fit him? You know, there are some people who can do B2C and some people who can do B2B. The question to ask is this the founder? Is this the market? And is this the time? So these put together, right? I think time is like some kind of a common function across these put together. If you view it as that, like a time function across a founder, market, and is there any other quality that this is the time now? I think, you know, if you see that from a time, you know, it works really well to see it and see if it will work for a venture capital investor to invest at this point in time.
Absolutely. So the way I see it is just trying to break down what you've told now is A, look at the different personas of the founders who are approaching. Are they like more engineering driven, or are they like people who can bring forth a better sales revenue forecast, or, you know, things like that, where you understand the persona, and then move on to understanding if the whole product that they're pitching has a unique value. And as you said, is it as disruptive as possible? Not really in a very large scale or something, but at least for the fact that it has a unique proportion for it. And then the whole time and the market size that the product is dealing with. Is it going to the right market? And is the messaging right out there to the people at the right time that they need? Because if there is no necessity, I guess the whole existence of the product is questionable.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think that's rightly put, you know. Yeah. And also, right, very few investors, right, you know, think through as, you know, an archetype, you know, there's a product founder, there's a sales founder. Because people typically end up, you know, mostly comfortable investing in companies which have at least, you know, two founders. That's also something that people look for. It doesn't mean that, you know, a single founder will not get invested. People are more comfortable investing in, you know, at least a company having two founders. It kind of, you know, breaks that up. You know, imagine if somebody has a product founder and then the other founder is sales-driven founder. That's like a real great combination to have, right? Or somebody is a tech.
True.
Person is a sales-driven founder, so it kind of works really well when there are complementary skills, and, you know, investors are very comfortable when they see complementary skills that's possible, and they know that, you know, each is can stand on their own and can drive a certain set of functions for the company. And just a product founder alone, unique cases happen, but yes, they do happen.
Yeah, that's in a way true, as you stated, because there comes a stability to the entire team in that case, because you have different personas coming together as a combination, somebody with strengths from two different fields or three different fields, and together that can play a very great role on the shape that the product takes with the whole support from the VC. So I guess, yeah, as you mentioned, that's another interesting point. So going by this, what's the biggest mistake you saw an entrepreneur or a startup founder do? And how do you deal with it as a VC who has invested in them in an early stage?
Oh, so I think, you know, I think we should make a good distinction between a mistake and a failure, right? Yeah. So I think we expect, you know, there will be mistakes, but question is, you know, what's the magnitude of the mistake that somebody is going to make, right? And if a mistake results due to externalities, you know, that's definitely a mistake, right? But if there are really something that people clearly understand and then make a mistake, right? That's not something that VCs are comfortable with, right? When I'm talking of those mistakes, you know, I'm talking of, you know, something which is not legal, or fraud, those kind of stuff, right? So those are obviously,
Okay,
nobody is
yeah.
comfortable with those kind of mistakes. It's not even a mistake, you're consciously doing something in a way. So mistakes are fine, and VCs are, are okay with, companies pivoting, if they realize, this product doesn't work. That's learnings in a way, learning from those small failures. That's like, people are really fine with that, and if they pivot and then they figure out, what is the product market fit and is this product to work? And I think people
True.
are comfortable with that, but, it should not be, you go with a notion of presenting a plan on day one and, tomorrow morning you change the product completely, say, let's say from B2B to B2C after you get the money. And that's not a comfortable situation to deal with. So there has to be a logic and a rationale to, why did that happen and why did you make it and what are you moving into, right? That's there. I think mistakes are part of, the startup game. And I mean, I think as investors, we do a portfolio and we also make a mistake. We're consciously aware that, we are not going to get everything right. So I think,
True.
Founders will also make those mistakes. What's the magnitude of the mistakes? Does it result in fraud is the question. I mean, that's not pardonable. Otherwise, I think, mistakes are fine. And as long as people can learn and from that and move on, and make something larger out of that, I think that people are fine with, We use our resources wherever possible, to try and help them so that, they can focus on what they really are good at.
Yeah, that's so true. It's like, at the end of the day, you are accountable for the money that you're using. So I think if that point is, etched deep into the minds, and also for the fact that thinking it's their own money that's going into the whole play, I guess, yeah, as you stated, it's going to be a different story. And another point that I see in this case is, obviously commit to what you've pitched. And obviously, there are going to be stepstones, and you might have digressions in the whole path as you're trying to lead a product or a company. But, the larger destination, that's going to be the whole picture. And I think being upfront about those stepstones or failures, as we just called it, is more helpful, because you as a VC team would be there to help them out with the right resources and assist them wherever possible. So I guess the whole miscommunication could be, prevented when things are upfront between founders and between the VCs who are
I think
to
the transparency helps, constant communication helps. Have realized, this is not something that's workable, and then they return the money to the VC, whatever is remaining. So that clearly shows, people are mature enough, to go through the cycle and they understand, what happened.
Yeah, that's so true, because the whole collaboration is built on the line of trust. So I guess in this case, since they're being more matured about things and they know things are not working out, they are quite upfront and they're quite okay with returning back the money and, parting ways that are more comfortable for both the teams. So just as how venture capitalists question these teams, and as we were just talking about it, can you mention the most common interrogations that a product or a company owner should have with a VC before seeking an investment?
My sense is, the product owners should look, I always tell, founders, you going to VCs, is also a choice that you have, and which VCs you go to and what questions you can ask them is, is all a function of your choice, right? If you are building a particular product, you need to look at, who is this partner and which is this investing firm that will fit me really well. That's a question to ask, by looking at all the data, what companies has this person invested previously in, can he support me, does he have those networks, I think, product owners should do a lot more work before, even talking to a particular VC, right? That's my sense of the conversation, which very few product owners or founders do. They need to do a lot more. People easily compare it to marriage, right? I mean, if you're going to get married to someone, you're going to do a lot of checks, balances, quality. You look, does it really fit into my long-term story? I think this is something similar. Product owners first, even before talking to, need to look at, create a process to say, these are the VCs that I'm going after, and this is the person I want to have, and this is the person I want to have on board, and this is the person I want to work with. So once that is done, right, asking, when you meet the VC, asking questions, do they, or, asking questions in such a way, right, if you can figure out, does this person or believe in the vision that I have, will the partner stand by me in both good and bad times for the long term? if you put your questions across in such a way that can you measure, you know, is the partner or the investor as passionate, you know, does he show enough believability in your product? You know, those are the things that you need to find in a conversation, and you can't ask that to basically saying, you know, do you believe in my product, right? So it is a very nuanced understanding of conversation. You know, it is visible. It is visible. Somebody has to just look for the signals in a conversation, and it will show up. You know, saying, you know, in the excitement and the kind of questions that the investor he himself will ask you, and the warmth and, you know, getting back to each of these conversations, right, will clearly show, you know, he's passionate about it and he believes in the vision of the founder. If those two are there, right, I think the product owner should, you know, believe that, you know, this person will help me to take it further over the years.
You know, I've read where people say finding a co-founder for your company is more like finding a life partner. But I guess from what we just discussed, even finding a VC for a company when you're mutually invested in this is like finding a whole partner who has or who shares the same thought process as you do. It's like because each of us have different style of working, different traits, different visions. So finding that person who is okay to get into a journey with you, a shared vision with you, and trying to see the same picture in a way that you are seeing is
yeah,
the main point.
And then also, right, you know, I think, you know, if you notice investments across the years in India, right, you would notice a pattern, you know, where 50% of the people come from a set of colleges, say from IIT, IIMs, a set of colleges. It is also because, you know, there is a level of trust between them, which is kind of got built in. They're more comfortable with dealing people who think, you know, are alike at some level. It is a factor. I mean, I sometimes believe, you know, it should not be a factor, but it is as is.
Certainly. I think it's that amicability and that rapport that you think that you can build with the person. And as you just said, like finding people from the same institutions or maybe somebody who shared the same career experiences, there's an instant rapport you tend to build with them because you think or you automatically get into that thought process that, hey, I'm going to be really comfortable with this person because I know somewhere we share this perspective. So I guess that's the whole theory behind this. Yeah, moving on to one of our last questions. What are the current hot market segments and trends in this tech startup industry that you see while speaking to a lot of founders as a VC? And how do you evaluate
this? This question is actually, right, like something that I thought of it because, you know, people, trends, right, hot, especially hot trends come and go at some level. But it also, right, builds into this fundamental theory. You can make investments in multiple ways, right? Like you make contrarian investments, you make investments in trend, or you know, you build up a thesis and you make those investments. There's multiple possible ways of making investments. This is one of the ways, you know, to keep track of, you know, what's currently happening in the market. So if you ask me, right, what is current keeps changing? Like let's say last year, you know, if you see, you know, there's a lot of income sharing agreement. Kind of a concept which came from Lambda. That was last year. Then we also saw a wave of you know, brands and brands getting funded. So currently, right, at least, you know, if you ask me personally, the one which I'm like pretty interested in, very curious about currently is the trend on influencers and curation. That market seems to be maturing well. There are a few companies, I think, you know, early looking interesting signs. So that's a trend, you know. So a trend comes and goes, you know, and it's like in less than 6 to 8 months, you know, you just see, you know, a bunch of companies getting funded. What will survive or not is a question, and what will become big is a question. But trends do come and move on. But I think, you know, as investors, we are conscious, you know, you can do a bit of trend investing also so that, you know, you don't miss on large market opportunities. But also, I think we are aware that, you know, you need to look at sometimes, you know, opportunity outside the trend, or like a lot of times I would say outside, you know, which is either a bottom-up thesis or a top-down building a thesis, or, you know, going contrarian, you know, when everybody is talking of a trend, but you just go exactly in the other direction where nobody is looking and make an investment. Largely are driven by two kind of data points, I would say. One, you know, what's kind of emerging in the Valley and China. For example, social commerce, you know, when PDD happened in China, and there's a bunch of social commerce startups that happened in India. the only way to, you know, identify some trends is, you know, keep an eye on what's happening in the Valley, what's happening in China, gather information, talk and engage companies and in the adjacencies, you know, talk to community, people, fellow VCs and market.
That's so true. I think it's a dynamic hotbed where you have like fleeting trends and as you said, don't be so glued on certain things. Like if this is going to happen, I think it's going to stick for a long period of time. Because I think venture capitalism, the whole market by itself is going to be very dynamic. And gathering these trends and collaborating and networking within the VC circle. And then, yeah, trying to have a whole perspective being discussed
yeah.
is a
yeah,
good idea.
That works really well. So far, it's worked. There could be a lot of companies which may go down because of this current epidemic or pandemic, that's right. So given all that, you need a little bit of
yes.
luck. That's what I've always believed in. And there is a little bit of serendipity and there's a little bit of luck. And you just need to keep your eyes open, always, you know, open to having the chance conversation. I call this as optionality, you know, having those chance conversations every now and then. Those mm-hmm. lead and sometimes open doors and mm-hmm. leads sometimes to success also, right?
Yeah, I think you've put it forward in the most simplest manner. Like, just be abreast of what's happening around you and, yeah, things will fall into place. Yeah, thank you so much, Vinod, for today's session. I think I've personally picked up a lot of points and it was lovely talking to you about this whole VC concept, the anecdotes and the stats that you stated to simplify this whole concept and sort of demystify what's happening in this the most glamorous market. And I guess the listeners would also agree on that point. So thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Again,
thanks, Aishwarya. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And this is probably, or like, this is the first podcast, I think, where I've spoken out. Hopefully people find it interesting.
I think it was really interesting. And this did not seem like your first podcast. Also, because I guess somewhere you rightly understood the kind of points that our audience also needs to, you know, get a whole hang of this concept. So it was really fun and
interesting
to talk about this whole thing.